From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is a country whose people are deeply rooted in faith and also deeply suspicious of it. In God We Trust still appears in our U.S. currency, but just who that God is and what role God plays in our lives is very much a topic of debate. Recently, though, in the wake of the Charleston, South Carolina church shootings and the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage, that conversation is part of the national conversation and not just among clergy. Words like forgiveness, grace, and sin are being heard recently in places they do not usually surface. So, are the faithful changing the country, or is the country changing the faithful? This hour, On Point, talking faith in our public lives. You can join us on air or online. If you belong to a faith community, how are they and you talking about recent events, especially the Charleston church shootings and the Supreme Court ruling? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll also talk about faith and the 2016 presidential race. Right now, I'm joined by a group of people who've thought deeply about the role of faith in the public sphere. They include two members of the clergy. With us from Washington, D.C., Reverend Delman Coates. He's senior pastor of the 8,600-member Mount Enon Baptist Church in Clinton, Maryland. That's a suburb of Washington, D.C. He's also part of a group of clergy that's seeking to reinvigorate the role of African-American clergy in public life. Pastor Coates, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
From Wheaton, Illinois, Beth Felker-Jones. She's associate professor of theology at Wheaton College. She professes the evangelical tradition. Welcome, Professor Jones. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. Good to be with you.
And with us from Hartford, Connecticut, Reverend Josh Pollack. He's parish minister at Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. Reverend Pollack, welcome to you as well. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Michelle. It's good to be here.
And I wanted to start by asking each of you how you are responding to the events that I wanted to focus on today. Are your parishioners and students asking you to speak about them? And what are you saying? And Pastor Coates, I'll start with you.
Well, I think because our ministry has always been committed to a ministry of public engagement, of connecting our faith to civic involvement, we have a long history of addressing racism, mass incarceration. I've been a leader on marriage equality and a range of other issues in our state and across the country. And so we already have a built-in culture and tradition of public engagement, which is very much a part of the Black church tradition of connecting our theology with our sociology. And so for, I think our those in our congregation have been prepared for addressing these issues.
So they would expect you. Your parishioners would, your congregants would expect you to be speaking on these issues.
Absolutely.
Have you been preaching on this? Have you preached on this?
Well,
these issues?
Well, absolutely. We have been connecting. We have been addressing forgiveness. Not long ago, I did a series on forgiveness. So it was interesting in your opening that you referenced forgiveness and grace and sin being used in the public square. But what I'm most interested in the actions that are applied to our God talk. So to dissociate our God talk from conversation about the about what human actions are ought to result from our God talk, it sort of trivializes our theology. And so we're very much interested in restorative justice and God talk to what end. So forgiveness to what end? Mercy to what end? Grace to what end? And so if it leaves in place the same systems of racial, social, systemic inequality, we trivialize our God talk. However, if our God talk is connected with human action and restorative justice, then we can help to make our community a better place.
Mm. What about you, Reverend Pollack? Are you preaching on these issues? I do note that the Unitarian Universalist denomination has been an early supporter of same-sex marriage or of marriage equality. So, I would imagine that your parishioners or your congregants would not be surprised to hear you speak about these issues. But what about these other issues we've talked about?
No, on marriage equality and other gay and lesbian civil rights and transgender civil rights, my congregation is not surprised at all to hear me preach about these things or to be out in the public square speaking about these things, testifying at the legislature, speaking with the governor, whoever it is, my congregation expects it and they're there with me. And that is a longstanding commitment of the Unitarian Universalist Association and our congregations. On other issues, they expect that too, and they're also very used to it. I have served the congregation in Manchester now for 12 years and have aspired to bring an anti-racist, a white anti-racist lens to everything that I do there. This year, we've been, as a congregation and myself, involved in a number of Black Lives Matter actions. We have a Moral Monday Connecticut. I was recently arrested at a Moral Monday Connecticut action. And my congregation, although I'm sure not everyone approves of that, a lot of them approve. And they see it as a very important part of our public witness and bringing our faith to the public square. That's a very important thing for us.
What about you, Professor? You are evangelical. We have seen a furious reaction to the Supreme Court's same-sex ruling from many conservative clergy, many of them evangelical. I don't know whether they speak for you as well, but I am interested in your perspective on what they're saying. I do want to play a short clip, if you don't mind, from Franklin Graham, which is a name many people might know. He was speaking to Fox News on June 26th after the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states. He, of course, is president and CEO of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and Samaritan's Purse. This is what he said to Fox News.
I'm disappointed because our government is recognizing sin. This court is endorsing sin. And that's what homosexuality is. It's a sin against God, just like any other sin. But for the court to endorse sin, I'm saddened for our country.
What about you, Professor Felker-Jones? First, I'm interested in your reaction, and if you could help us understand the reaction of a number of conservative and evangelical clergy. What are they feeling right now?
Sure, I'll do my best. And just Jones is fine. As a teacher, I think it's very important to try to help my students think through various perspectives on these questions. And I don't think, contrary to media representation often, that Franklin Graham speaks for all evangelicals. Certainly, there are big divisions among evangelicals about how to think about the relationship between church and state. So given the clip just played, whether something is a sin or not, I am not at all surprised that the court doesn't think about things that some Christians would think about as a sin as sin. The court is not the church. The country is not the church. And I don't think that Christians, evangelical or otherwise, should expect law to necessarily reflect Christian teaching or practice.
What are you hearing for the most part, Professor? I'm hearing in that clip sadness, but I'm also hearing in other communications a lot of anger, a real cry, a call to resist. And others are calling, for example, I'm thinking about Russell Moore, who's the president of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is kind of an influential group that often weighs in on matters of public concern. And he's been describing what he calls a strategy of explanation and engagement, where he's saying that for example, in an interview he did with Huffington Post, he says that he thinks there have been errors made, you know, on the part of conservative Christians in addressing these issues. He says, I think the other error was some people speaking to this issue from my side who were angry and presented a public face of outrage in a way that I don't think was helpful. And his argument is that now people really need to explain their convictions and the reason behind them in a way that they perhaps had not done. How does that strike you?
That strikes me as relatively sane, amongst a lot of rhetoric that isn't necessarily sane. Certainly, I don't think Christianity is about the kind of anger towards people who are seen as different that you do often so often hear quoted. Evangelical Christians are about sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ with the world, and to do that, we need to witness to the goodness and the truth of who God is, not yell at people. And I think that many evangelicals get frustrated with the way the faith is portrayed in the media, the way some of those noisy and often angry voices get a lot of space.
What about you, Pastor Coates? How does that strike you?
Well, if I may, I'm one of those evangelical Christians frustrated as well. I identify as a progressive evangelical Christian, and I'm not willing to concede the terms of the debate, as you heard in the clip. I think it's important for people to understand that there are Bible-believing Christians who support marriage equality or same-sex marriage, not despite their religion, but because of it. As a pastor and as a Bible scholar, I do not believe that the Bible condemns homosexuality. I have yet to find one passage of Scripture that condemns consensual, same-gender-loving people. The texts that are often appropriated and used to condemn gays and lesbians are texts that are condemnations of acts of sexual violence, rape, abuse, and exploitation, all of them. And I realize that certain English transliterations give the impression that these are condemnations of gays and lesbians, but they're not. And I think this is a great opportunity for people of faith, those for whom Scripture is their source of authority, to reinterrogate the texts that we claim to be authoritative. The other thing that really concerns me is this notion that the government is recognizing sin. I think people of faith need to place a greater emphasis on public morality rather than issues of private morality. I believe that Scripture addresses matters of poverty, inequality, how we treat the foreigner and the stranger in our land, more so than it does addressing some of these issues of private morality. We need a coalition of people of faith across religious traditions that are committed to addressing inequality in our country across the board.
So you're saying it's a teachable moment. Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back. We can ask about what is it a moment to teach. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at expressions of faith from the pulpit and elsewhere in the public sphere in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage and the Charleston church shootings. You can join the conversation. Have you found messages from faith leaders helpful in addressing the issues facing the country? Do you want your clergy weighing in on social issues? And also, what's your response to Pope Francis when he takes on climate change? We're talking this hour with Reverend Josh Pollack, a Unitarian Universalist minister. Also with us, Professor Beth Felker-Jones, who adheres to the evangelical tradition, and with Reverend Delman Coates, a Baptist minister. Before we took our break, Pastor Coates was telling us that he sees this as a teachable moment to remind the country that the faith has many voices, if I have that right, Pastor Coates,
yes,
and that interpretations of the Bible can take many forms. Anything else you want to add to that?
I think this is an opportunity for progressives to reengage in the public square. I think over the past four decades, liberals and progressives in our country have conceded religion, gave up on religion, as it were. And in that chasm and in that void, those of a more conservative political orientation stepped into that chasm and have begun to dominate the theology and political theology for people of faith. I think that what you're seeing now are liberals and progressives unapologetically saying that there is a religious left in this country. Many of the movements for progress and change in this country were led by progressive people of faith. And so I think this is a moment for liberals and progressives who identify as Christian or progressive Jews or progressive Muslims or progressive agnostics and atheists, right, whose faith is in humanity and justice, are reengaging in the public square and unapologetically affirming their faith tradition.
Let's hear a different perspective. I'd like to bring in Aaron, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Aaron, are you with us?
Yes, hi, Michelle.
Okay, Aaron, how about you? How are you responding to this?
Not only am I surprised, but I'm very disturbed not only by the comments of the guest that you have just now, but of the church as a whole. I'm an associate minister at my church, but just as a Christian, we've read the Bible and we've heard for years that to expect these type of changes in our society, and that's to be expected from a progressive society, but one and one still equals two. That's not going to change no matter what year it is on the calendar, and God still stands for something. And I'm surprised and shocked almost at the lack of resistance of a church that claims to be a church of God, of the Bible, and how they're caving in to the public demands to accept whatever and to take away right and wrong and create these gray areas and everything, and just basically just become worthless in carrying the message that God has left for us to carry, which is there is a right and wrong.
Aaron, what do you think the church should be doing?
The church should be standing on the Word of God. It's wrong.
And by it, I assume you mean, by it, forgive me, Aaron, by it, I assume you mean what?
It was wrong, and we stood mm-hmm. against it. And even though we can't change society, mm-hmm. we can say that we disagree with it. The gay marriage thing is the same way. We don't have to agree with it. We can say it's wrong, and we don't have to say that we can change it, but we can disagree with it.
All right. Let's hear from Beth Felker-Jones. Professor, what do you think about that?
I think the church should absolutely resist the world, if we want to use that kind of language, where it is wrong. I think that Reverend Coates is quite right that this is a issue which evangelical Christians currently disagree upon in terms of biblical interpretation. So as a kind of feminist evangelical, I'm worried about letting go of the importance of difference in marriage and the importance of women's bodies and men's bodies as a problem for women, a problem of kind of erasing women. But there's a complicated and interesting conversation to be had. There are also questions, and I think Aaron's question reflects this, about how best to resist the world. Does resistance look like looking for laws that agree with church teaching? Does resistance look like living faithfully in community in a way that reflects the goodness of God? And we're having these conversations. It's hard work. It's hard work for the church. I'm a United Methodist as well as an evangelical, and the United Methodist Church is deeply divided on this, and I think it's really important that we figure out how to live together and love each other across that difference of opinion, that difference of understanding. If we just flee to our own groups, then we've really lost something important.
Reverend Pollock, what about that? I mean, where should the church stand on matters on which people are deeply divided? People have very different views about not just, you know, sexual morality, but also how racial justice and other issues should be pursued, if indeed at all, or how much of a priority it should be. Where should the church stand in matters like this?
I think the hard part about answering that question is that there are many churches and there are many religious bodies. There are many religions. We live in a very pluralistic society. And when I hear Reverend Aaron lamenting the Supreme Court decision on marriage equality, I hear actually some profound grief that his expectation that the world would somehow look like the vision that his particular church holds up is lost, that he's lost that. As for my part, I feel, you know, back to Dr. Coates's point about public morality, the church needs to stand for public morality. And by that, I mean social justice and economic justice. I agree that Scripture calls us to stand for social justice and economic justice, among other things. And that's where I want the church to stand. And if that means marriage equality, so be it. And if that means ending the school-to-prison pipeline, so be it. And if that means, education reform, if it means immigration reform, so be it. We need to stand for justice.
What responsibility do you feel to introduce your concepts or concepts as you understand them into the public sphere?
Reverend, I feel
Pollock.
Very.
I mean, your understanding of what forgiveness means, your understanding of what justice means, and what is the proper way for you to do that?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways. You know, after the Mother Emanuel shooting in South Carolina, I think the very appropriate way, especially for me as a white pastor serving a white congregation, is to hear what the AME leadership is asking white congregations to do, and to hear what you know, what some of the other activists around the country are asking us to do. And a lot of it at that time was about being part of vigils and prayer and ringing bells in church on Sunday morning. But I also think it's important to remember that although there was one shooter, there was a culture that produced him, and there are institutions that produced him. And the church needs to, in the public square, I think, name the evil at the heart of those institutions, at the heart of that culture, and to dismantle it, to work to dismantle it. And that involves community organizing and public witness and public advocacy and many other tools.
Well, speaking of public advocacy, I mean, there's a moment that I think shook many people to their core. And speaking of the shooting at Mother Emanuel AME in Charleston, South Carolina, is when the family members of some of the victims spoke to the alleged gunman, Dylan Roof, at his first bond hearing. I just want to play a short clip. And this is Nadine Collier, who's the daughter of one of the victims, 70-year-old shooting victim Ethel Lance. And this is what she said.
To you, I forgive you. You took something very precious away from me. I will never talk to her ever again. I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you.
I think I'm on firm ground when I say that I think for many people that was an extremely moving moment, but also puzzling for many people, Pastor Coates.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people just do not understand how someone could say that to somebody at a time like that, is still at a moment when the grief is still fresh. Can you help people explain that, understand that? And how is that an important moment of witness?
Well, the only way that I can explain it is to really understand the flip side of forgiveness. The word to forgive means to release. Many people think that this means to absolve the offender. But the word to forgive or to release is also about releasing the self from the pain, from the action that was committed by the other person. So when I hear people saying that they forgive this person, what I hear them saying is that they are going to release themselves from the pain, from the sense of vindication, the desire for vengeance that can naturally creep into one's heart, and to perhaps channel that into more productive means. I mean, I don't think there aren't many people who can relate to this kind of pain and trauma, and many people are surprised. There are many people in the African American community who have said that African Americans have been too forgiving, which is why I opened up saying that I am more interested in the human actions that follow our God talk. And so I'm interested in forgiveness to what end. And as Reverend Pollock mentioned, we have got to name and work collectively to address the systemic issues that created this young man. And it's not until we commit to addressing that we're going to make our country a better place.
I want to bring up in the time that we have left for this particular segment, something that's a very real issue for many of our listeners and a lot of the people who want to participate in our conversation. And I want to go to Colin on this, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. And that is the whole question of the appropriateness of having this public dialogue at all, or introducing these concepts into the public sphere. So, Colin, are you with us?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
So I'm a public school teacher in rural South Carolina outside of Columbia. And one of my bosses, one of my administrators, is a reverend in our church. And I find myself asking this question frequently, you know, how much should discussions of religion and faith come into the public school at all? We have prayers before every faculty meeting, which, I mean, personally made me feel uncomfortable, but, you know, we respect the tradition. But I have kids in the last few years that asked me about these things already. I'm frankly terrified for the beginning of the next school year with more questions that are going to come after what happened this summer. You know, do we have these discussions in the public school classroom, especially in a place like South Carolina, which seems to be the epicenter of some of these issues?
So is that your, I guess I'm still a little puzzled about what it is that's concerning you. Is it that you feel that these conversations shouldn't be taking place at school at all? Or you feel ill-equipped to lead them?
I'm concerned about the role of faith. Mm-hmm. I feel that because I have, as a middle school teacher, I've got 13, 14-year-olds asking me questions like, well, my dad is saying this, but how do you feel about this situation, whether it be gay marriage, which we discussed at length throughout the year. We watch the news every day. I teach social studies. And my opinion is more or less irrelevant, and especially my view of faith is irrelevant. I'm concerned with what role the public school system is going to play in fostering these discussions with young people.
Mm, I appreciate that. Thanks so much for calling. And I have to tell you that I wanted to tell our guests that we're getting many, many calls and emails on this point. Many of them, the subject line says separation of church and state, separation of church and state. I mean, I have about four kind of right in front of me right now. For example, let's see, one person says, from a listener on Facebook, I'm indifferent to religion. I respect other people that try to live that way. It's their choice. It appears to be a choice of grace and strength. I was truly moved by the people of Charleston in the wake of this tragedy. What I cannot deal with are the charlatans using God as a battering ram, separation of church and state. And a number of other callers are saying that I would have a lot more respect for religion if they just stayed out of the public sphere. So, Professor, do you want to take that question?
Sure. I personally hold to a pretty strong understanding of separation of church and state. And I think one of the issues that's coming up here right now for evangelical Christians, especially those who stand on the so-called traditional side of conversations about marriage, is whether that traditional position will continue to be protected as a separate thing from the state. Can the state recognize marriage equality and give rights to all married couples, which I think it can and should? Can it do that at the same time as it protects religious institutions and religious people who hold a different opinion? So the church and state question kind of rolls both ways here, and many conservative people are pretty concerned about this now.
This is a concern that the minority in the Supreme Court, the four-member minority of the on the same-sex marriage decision, expressed in rather pungent terms, if I may say. They're concerned that actually the actual free exercise of religion will be compromised by those who don't agree with this decision. Professor, do you mind if I ask you, are you personally concerned that your ability to teach and for those who preach to preach as they see the truth will in fact be compromised as a result of this decision if they don't agree with it? Is that a personal concern of yours?
I'm not personally concerned that I will be stopped from teaching what I think is the truth. But I am concerned that really good institutions, say of Christian higher education, will stop being able to be what they have been, which is vibrant centers of faith and learning, if they lose accreditation or lose protection as religious entities that disagree with the public opinion here.
Anybody else? Does anyone else have concerns? Reverend Pollack, Pastor Coates, do either of you? Go ahead, Reverend Pollack.
I have no concerns. I do think that there's a fine line. Maybe it's not a fine line. Maybe it's a big difference between a principal in a school expecting the faculty to join him or her in prayer versus a faith leader or a person of faith expressing themselves in the public square in a way that in doing so they hope to influence the outcome of a legislative process, or they hope to influence a politician's opinion. I think that's a big difference. I tend to feel that that prayer in the public school is problematic, but any person of faith has the right to express their opinion in public.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the national conversation about faith, and you can join the conversation. What are you hearing in this national conversation about faith, hope, and religious teachings? We're talking with Beth Felker-Jones, Associate Professor of Theology from Wheaton College, Reverend Delman Coates, Senior Pastor of Mount Enon Baptist Church, and with Reverend Josh Pollack, Parish Minister at Unitarian Universalist Society East. I'd like to bring some callers into the conversation now. Karen is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Karen, welcome.
Hi, Michelle. I am a Nichiren Buddhist in Charleston. The word Buddha means one who is fully awake. We chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo with confidence in our innate Buddhahood to reach our highest potential. We dispel self-doubt. We challenge our problems courageously. At the center of our global movement, currently we are 12 million strong and practicing in about 192 countries and territories. Mm-hmm. At the center of our global movement, we have a neighborhood of gatherings. You will see Asians. You will see African Americans. You will see Caucasians. You will see homosexuals. You will see transgendered people in our meetings. We welcome everyone to attend and to participate in this interpersonal relationship, to create friendship and dialogue. So I just wanted to express that, you know, this is a format that is talking about Christianity and everything that entails, but this is also another important, you know, religious component.
I agree with that, Karen. So thank you again for pointing that out. I meant to point out at some point that this is a religiously diverse country, although the overwhelming majority of people who profess a religion still do identify with Christianity. But Karen, thank you so much for pointing that out. But Beth Felker-Jones, I wanted to go back to the question we spoke of earlier, which is the number of people who are not professing any faith tradition at all. And I'm going back to the interview that Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention had with the Huffington Post earlier. And in that interview, it was cited that, you know, two recent studies suggest that the influence of religious social conservatives is waning dramatically. The Pew Research Center statistics show that both the number of Americans who identify as Christian has dropped and that the number of people who are religiously unaffiliated has grown over the last 5 years. Meanwhile, the Public Religion Research Institute released a study showing that nearly a third of millennials who left the faith that they grew up in did so, they say, because of quote-unquote negative teachings or quote-unquote negative treatment related to gays and lesbians. And so I wanted to ask, you know, how do you see that? Is this in part a generational issue, but the response that people have to opinions that they don't agree with is to leave the faith entirely? And is there any way to address that?
I think it's really hard to sort that all through. Are the millennials who've left the church people who were really committed practitioners of faith, or were they the sorts of people attached to faith who don't find it central to their lives? That's an interesting question. I do think it's a generational issue, and I see my undergraduate students wrestling with it in different ways. I'd say the vast majority of my undergrads are committed to a fairly traditional Christian theology in terms of sexual behavior, but also very much want to love everyone and to be seen as loving in the world, and are trying to figure out how to do that. It's also the case, though, that religious bodies that are growing both in this country and around the world tend to be evangelical style or conservative in some way religious bodies. So while we worry about young people leaving the church, I don't believe the answer is to give up the traditional distinctives of Christian faith. Mm-hmm. That's just not played out in what's really happening. The church is exploding around the world. It's growing in leaps and bounds all over the place. And that explosion is coming back to the West to ask us to be in conversation with the church around the world. It's not as simple as what the 20-year-old U.S. white kids mostly think. Hmm. I want to know what the whole world thinks.
What about that, Reverend Pollack? What about that?
I think that The question, particularly of millennials, is not a new question. And I know, at least in Unitarian Universalist congregations and white mainline churches, appealing to young people is a longstanding challenge. It was Gen Y before the millennials and Gen X before Gen Y. And what I notice is that there are different spiritual personalities. And some people want church on Sunday morning. Some people want a very small kind of house church. Some people want a huge church with great music and the lyrics up on the screen. And some people want the ancient church. And some people want something that feels modern. Some people, atheists want to be with fellow atheists sometimes. Sometimes they want to be in a more pluralistic setting, like a Unitarian Universalist congregation. And then there are many, many people who clearly, the data show, just don't want to be part of anything that looks like organized religion. I'm not so concerned about that personally. I think there still are people who want to be part of organized religion, and we need to figure out how to appeal to them. Sometimes taking a stand on marriage equality is a way to appeal to them, but we've been doing that for a long time, and that's not always that's not always the answer.
A final thought from you, Reverend Coates. I'm interested in what is your right. pressing and present concern? I mean, especially as a person who's been part of a movement to sure. not just revive, I'm not sure if revive is the right word, but to revive the progressive African-American tradition as a having a presence on the sure. national and world stage. What sure. are your thoughts about this?
Well, as president of the Black Church Center for Justice and Equality, our whole goal is to reclaim the social justice tradition of the Black church. And there are a range of social justice issues that we're focused on, income inequality, economic injustice, the school to prison pipeline, addressing mass incarceration and criminal justice reform, environmental justice. We believe that we need to do more to raise the voices of progressive African-American clergy on a range of issues. And on your prior question, I think the shifts that we're seeing in the spiritual marketplace today are really a function of people today rejecting Christian fundamentalism, which emerged in a at a time before the postmodern world. I think this is a great opportunity for the church to reimagine itself in a new environment today, a more diverse world that we're in today.
Reverend Delman Coates, thanks so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
Reverend Josh Pollack, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Professor Beth Felker-Jones, thank you so much for joining us today.
My privilege.
In a moment, on the campaign trail, what the 2016 presidential candidates are saying about faith and politics. This is On Point. The 2016 candidates are talking about values and faith on the campaign trail, and with that, a whole lot of talk about their personal beliefs. Philip Rucker is a national political reporter for The Washington Post, and he's been looking at what the candidates are saying. Philip, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, glad to be here.
Is there a theme overall? There's a huge field on the Republican side. Many people associate with the evangelical tradition, with conservative religious traditions. So is there a theme overall in what they're saying?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there are 16 declared or likely candidates, so huge might even be an understatement. But they come from different religions. Some are Catholic, some are Christian, some are, very evangelical. Others are a little less religious in their politics. But we really saw this play out in their response to the gay marriage ruling at the Supreme Court a week and a half ago. A lot of candidates cited religious liberty, saying that they were opposed to the ruling, but they would now focus on religious liberty issues. Some really invoked their own personal faith in why they were against the ruling. Jeb Bush is one example who said he was against same-sex marriage because of his Catholic faith.
Well, you know, speaking of, you know, Pope Francis is currently in Latin America, but before that, he got a lot of attention around the world with his missive on climate change. And I was
exactly.
interested in whether that was something that did that resonate on the campaign trail. Is that something that people were talking about?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because that's an issue that's been somewhat problematic for the Republican Party. The scientists, of course, are in pretty much widespread agreement that the Earth is getting warmer, that climate change is real, and that human activity contributes to that. That is not necessarily the position that all the Republican candidates have taken. And, you know, not all of them responded directly to the Pope's declaration a couple of weeks ago, but we're going to see this come up, I think, again and again in the campaign. If not now, then certainly in a general election. I've been out on the trail a little bit with Hillary Clinton, and one of her most popular lines in her stump speech is when she says, you know, Republicans need to listen to the scientists who know what they're talking about on climate change. It's a pretty effective attack for the Democrats, and I think we're going to see that next year for sure.
Well, before we move to the Democrats, because I do want to ask about the Democrats, because they do have faith traditions of their own, at least most of them do, of the declared candidates. Before we do, I do want to just play a short clip of Republican presidential candidate, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, trying to thread the needle on the whole climate change question. Jeb Bush is a Catholic. I believe he's a Catholic. He does profess Catholicism now, right? He embraces the Catholic Church. Does he not, Philip?
That's correct. Yes.
And he was saying that the Pope should steer clear of issues like climate change. This is what he said.
I don't get economic policy from my bishops or my cardinals or from my Pope. And I'd like to see what he says as it relates to climate change and how that connects to these broader, deeper issues before I pass judgment. But I think religion ought to be about making us better as people and less about things that end up getting into the political realm.
But how does that work, though, Philip? If the other candidate is this can you help me understand what he's saying here? Is it he's saying that he's interested in the Pope's guidance on some issues, but if other candidates are putting their faith perspectives at the forefront, I mean, they're saying, in essence, that my politics are a reflection of my faith and not the other way around. Is this considered to be a distinguishing factor for him, or how do you hear what he just said?
Yeah, you know, I think he's just trying to have a little distance here. He doesn't want to make it seem like his politics are just a rubber stamp of what his church says. So on the issue of climate change, he's going to have his own sort of nuanced policy proposals and beliefs about the science and beliefs about the environmental policy, and that'll be different from what the Catholic Church believes. We saw this play out also in 2012 when Mitt Romney was running. He was the first Mormon to be at a major party nominee in a presidential race. And he was asked a lot of questions about the beliefs of his church. And he always had a similar answer to what Governor Bush just said, which is that, you know, he believes deeply in his church, but his church doesn't dictate his politics or his policy beliefs. And I think some of these candidates certainly want their religion to be a part of their candidacies and their campaigns. And they want voters to understand that they're people of faith, but they don't want it to seem like they're just going to be a rubber stamp in office for the wishes of their church.
Well, of course, it's different when churches have different governance systems, of course. I mean, that some religious practices don't have like a central figure like the Pope. But for those candidates who are emphasizing their religious practices, how is that going so far? Noting that even one candidate, Ted Cruz, announced his candidacy or started his candidacy at an important religious institution, a religious college. How is that going so far? At Liberty University. How is that being received so far?
It's interesting. There are a lot of candidates, and they're handling this differently. Some of the candidates on the far right of the Republican Party have been really cloaking their entire candidacies in religion and faith, and that's a deliberate strategy, I think, in particular in Iowa, which is the state that hosts the first presidential caucuses. There's a base of the Republican Party there that is very evangelical, very socially conservative. They want candidates of faith. They voted for Rick Santorum in 2012. They voted for Mike Huckabee, a former Baptist preacher and the governor of Arkansas in 2008. And we're seeing a lot of candidates out there in Iowa in a way sort of pander to this element of the party. But not all of the candidates are doing that. Jeb Bush is a little different. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, a little different. And certainly some of the candidates who are focusing on New Hampshire, like New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, I mean, religion is really not a part of his campaign at all.
But in the time that we have left, let's hear about the Democrats. What's their challenge? I mean, one can see for the Republicans, the challenge would be to identify themselves as people of faith, but to give themselves some room in the fall for people who don't share those particular perspectives, I would imagine. What about for the Democrats? What's their challenge and where are they positioning themselves on this issue?
Yeah, well, for starters, faith is really less of a focal point of the Democratic primary. It's not something that the candidates talk an awful lot about. And I don't think, frankly, it's something that a lot of Democratic primary voters look for in their candidates. That being said, Hillary Clinton has actually talked about her church upbringing a little bit on the trail, being a Methodist girl. She, you know, she grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. She spent a lot of her young adult life in Arkansas, where she was the first lady. And so she's been around faith politics and feels pretty comfortable in the church. We saw her visit a church outside of St. Louis a couple weeks ago, a black church. This was after the shooting in Charleston. So she's trying to talk a little bit about her faith. You know, I think in some ways it helps humanize her. She's a figure who's can be a bit robotic, can seem a little stiff. People feel like they know her and she can be kind of a caricature of herself. And I think by talking about her church upbringing, by talking about her faith and what she believes, she kind of adds a human dimension to her persona.
And of course, there's Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, who's a self-identified socialist. I don't know that I've ever heard him talk about any religious practice of his own. And of course, Martin O'Malley, who is a former governor of Maryland, who is Catholic. And then there's Jim Webb, who is, I believe, a Scottish Presbyterian, or at least that is his tradition. Have any of them talked about faith?
Not much that I've heard. I've seen a lot of Bernie Sanders events. He talks for about an hour, and I don't think I've ever heard him mention his faith. So a different approach there.
All right. Philip Rucker is a national political reporter at The Washington Post. He was kind enough to speak with us from Washington. Philip, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Coming up tomorrow on Point, Greeks spoke and said no to the European ultimatum. Folly or bravery, these are uncharted waters for Europe and Greece. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.